Good evening. Welcome to tonight's On the Edge with me, Theo Chalmers. In tonight's show, I'll be talking with Daniel Obuchike, a survivor of the bus bomb on 7th of July 2005 in Tavistock Square, who has written a book called The Fourth Bomb, which demands answers to some vitally important questions. We really have got an extraordinary show tonight. Daniel, welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
Good, I'm glad you could come. Now, this is your book, which I've read, and it's in a sense, I mean, it's a really good book, but in a sense, it's a very scary book, isn't it? Because there's things that you describe in here which demand to be considered as a separate version of what happened on that day. Not the official version.
Yes, that's how this book came about. Initially, people said, why didn't you just go to the police the day after and say what you saw? But I noticed things were changing from day to day in the media, from week to week, and from month to month. So I just kept a diary of what was going on around me, and very strange things were happening.
Let's backpedal a little bit, because you were on the bus, obviously, and you noticed certain things happening on the bus. I mean, it's clear from your book that you're a very observant man. So talk a little bit about your experience on the bus. Let's go from the bus to the bang and then on from there, shall we?
Well, the bus experience wasn't any different from any other bus ride I'd taken before. To work, it's boring. You're half asleep most of the time. You're just waiting on your tube. But for some reason, we were told there was a power surge, and then things started to change. So we were all got off the tube train at Euston and tried to get a bus. And it took ages for a bus. And when one finally turned up, it was a 2:05. I got on that bus thinking, yes, thank you, I can get to work now. And then the bus driver on that bus told me, no, you need a bus 30, because I said I needed to get to Angel. And that's how I ended up on the bus 30. And some strange things occurred on that ride in itself, which even before the actual explosion, and which caused me to ask what was going on. I boarded the bus and asked the driver, does this bus go to Angel? And the driver looked at me and said no after a second. I thought that's a bit odd, because his colleague had just told me that it did. So that was what made me stand downstairs where I was, watching people get on and listening to hear where they asked to get to. And he was saying, oh yes, it goes to this place and that place. I just wanted to get some verification. And
so were you just trying to get to as near as work as possible?
Yeah,
given that
essentially,
all the trains were
essentially
not working. Because this is after the three other bombs had gone off in the underground.
Yeah, it was. But I just stayed downstairs anyway, just to be on the safe side in case he was telling the truth. But from that position, I saw everyone more or less coming on that bus, because I kind of jumped the queue, because I'd been in front at the 2:05 and I was gutted that I'd have to be behind everyone else. So I just jumped to the front.
So you're the guy who jumps
It's me, yeah. So I saw all these people getting on, and no one fitting an Asian man with a rucksack got on. That's one thing which I knew, which kind of alarms me in the weeks.
Was the bus
following.
Empty then?
The bus was more or less empty.
Could he not have been upstairs when you didn't go upstairs?
They say that he was in the government narrative, which was in May the following year, a government narrative came on, which suggested that he was already on the bus. But hey, I'm not going to argue with that. I've got my own witness testimony of everything, all the events which occurred prior to and following that blast, which point in a completely different direction from the government narrative. I just waited until May the following year, because I was really looking forward to the government narrative just to see what they would say. And then when they came up with that, I would say, okay then, now I'm going to make my notes and my diary of what had been going on into, that's when I decided to make it into a book rather than just a PDF and a little website, which I was... Okay. Until then, is that what it was?
So this bus you got on, this was the 30, wasn't it? And it doesn't normally go to Tavistock Square, where it blew up, does it?
Not
so
normally.
describe to me how that happened then. How did the bus go to Tavistock Square and not on its normal route? Because there were no bombs at that time in the streets, were there, to divert buses?
There were these two vehicles in the Euston Road holding it up.
Just holding up your bus?
They were holding up the bus. There was a bus in front of it, the 205, which had gone through, but they stopped the 30. And then after about 3 or 4 minutes, I was getting a bit annoyed because time was ticking. I still hadn't got anywhere closer to my office. And I went to the front of the bus to look through the driver's window, and I saw them there. And a police motorcycle, came up to the two cars as if he was going to investigate and resolve whatever their issue was. And one of them appeared to wave some kind of card or identification at the police motorcyclist. And the motorcyclist just turned around and sped away. And I thought, okay, he sorted everything.
What kind of cars were these?
One was a Mercedes, one was a BMW, one was black, one was navy blue metallic.
Okay.
So the Mercedes was black, the BMW was navy blue metallic. So from that point, I thought, okay, why are they still there? So a minute or two later, one of them sped away, and then the bus driver began turning the wheel right down towards Tavistock Square.
Did they actually signal to this bus driver that he needed to go that route?
No, I don't know why the driver... Obviously, he couldn't proceed down the Euston Road.
Because the one was still there, wasn't
it? Yeah, one was still there. But as one of them went, he just turned right. So, obviously, based upon that, they were holding him there for some reason. So... anyway, that was that. We get into Tavistock Square. We're just approaching Tavistock Square, and there's this call out of the window. The bus driver yells something out the window, and then he asks, does anyone know where this road or this destination is? And then there's an explosion, and that's the moment where the bomb just goes off and everything is dark. And then
isn't there an event before then, though? Isn't there an event where the bus driver, for some reason, opens the middle doors of the bus to let people off, but not the front doors, to let people on? And this is before he's had a stop, is that right?
Yeah, that was once we'd entered Tavistock Square. There was I'm not sure why he did, he just opened the centre doors. And there was no bus stop, no one rang the bell. That was another one of the things which was slightly out of the usual, which made me kind of pay more attention to what was going on. So, and a whole bunch of people got off, especially from upstairs. Not many people from downstairs got off, but quite a few people from upstairs. And there was one person from upstairs who was sitting upstairs, but he came and sat downstairs when everyone was getting off and walking to King's Cross, which was only 10 minutes at the most walk away. So he was quite suspicious, I thought, and in time,
describe this man.
I thought this guy, who was European appearance, brown hair, light grey waterproof top, two-tone grey rucksack, in his mid-20s, early to mid-20s, later on, I realized that he was the only one who was upstairs and downstairs. So by virtue of the fact that he was upstairs, I thought, okay, he was British intelligence. I was wondering why we were exchanging looks at that point when people were getting off. And because I thought it was odd, he came upstairs and then from upstairs and sat downstairs. So I was giving him a bit of an eye.
Do you think maybe he thought you were British intelligence?
I have no idea what he thought. From what the other passengers downstairs, they thought I was an irritated young black man acting irritated on the lower deck, which was kind of strange because there was another guy who came to be on that bus called Richard Jones, who said later that he had seen an irritated looking person on the lower deck. I was just a bit annoyed that the bus was taking so long. I mean, I wasn't dipping into a bag or anything like that. But some of the females who survived, there were three females on the lower deck who survived. One of them, unfortunately, she didn't. But one of the three females gave a police, it was in the newspaper, she said, I had a agitated appearance which I thought was a bit much. I'm just trying to get to work like everyone else was.
Well, right? I know. If I was on a bus going the wrong way, I would probably be agitated.
So,
these doors open. Mm. Some people got off. So by now, there were fewer people on the bus. Yeah. No one got on. Mm. The bus carried on to Tavistock Square. Mm. Was it moving when the bomb went off?
It was stopping and starting. Traffic was not really moving, so it was crawling a bit, then it stopped for a bit, and then it stopped. The guy, the bus driver, said something out the window, called across the to someone across the square, and then that was when there was an explosion.
What did he call out?
He said, "Excuse me, do you know, is this Tavistock Square, or is this whatever road that road was called?"
Okay, so which is a bit unusual, isn't it, for a London bus driver?
Yeah, to me, that struck me as unusual for a bus driver to be asking directions from people in the street.
Okay.
So, I mean, it was a number of things that just all added up and say something is going on. It was a bit, it felt a bit staged. It felt a bit staged.
Okay, so where were you exactly when the bomb actually went off?
When the bomb went off, I was standing downstairs in the middle of the bus. That's where the baby buggies are left. There's a storage area there, and I was just by there.
Is that near the stairs?
Just beside the stairs, yeah. Near the centre of the bus. So initially I'd been on the other side, but as people started coming down the stairs to actually disembark, I tried to get out of their way, so that's why I ended up standing there.
So, describe the explosion.
It's just one of those things. You kind of hear it. Your body is trying to react, but there's no way your body can react fast enough. You're flying through the air, and it's very kind of, it's like slow motion. The glass was everywhere. There was darkness where there was once light, and it was a strange feeling. I mean, I describe it in the book. Very strange feeling. I thought time had been suspended, and I felt that way, and I saw my life, elements of my life flash before my eyes.
So. That's a classic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Did you go deaf?
No, not at all.
So, were you injured?
Minor. My hands and knees were cut because the glass was everywhere, so my hands were bleeding, obviously, and my trousers were sort of like torn and cut, but other than that, I had no time to really look at my injuries at that point, because I was just trying to put my head as close as it would be to the floor. I'm surprised there's not an imprint of my face on that floor. That's how hard I was pressing my face down. There were three females who also, to my left, were huddling together. They didn't really know what was going on, and they were staring at me, wide-mouthed and wondering what the hell is going on. So that was the immediate aftermath of the bomb. But I just wanted to get out of there, and that's what I decided to do. I thought about it. I looked through the door. There's a bit of a crack to the street. It was still sunny outside. And I said, is it worth it? And I said, yeah, I'm out of here. So it took me about 10-15 seconds and I was down
the
street.
You had to force the door, did you?
Not at all. It was the door, one of the doors was hanging off at an awkward angle. The front of the bus door was slightly open, so.
You went through the front?
Yeah.
And then what did you do?
I ran. As you do when there is a bomb explosion, you try to get as far away from it as you can.
Do you think this is just a sort of fight or flight response, just a normal human response, or were you thinking consciously maybe there'd be a second bomb, or did you not consider that maybe they might think you were the bomber?
That did kind of strike me. It flitted through my mind that I might be considered a terrorist or something running away from the bus. I mean, the image of a black man running away from a freshly destroyed bus may have struck people as something which might point to my guilt, but I just thought I've got to get as far away from here as possible, because the idea of secondary explosions kind of put in an appearance, because everywhere else there's ever been terrorist attacks, it's normally three or four. So to me, I knew it wasn't just a one-off thing. I've been in an IRA kind of situation. There was a bomb by the IRA at Blackfriars, and I was around the corner from that, so I kind of know what a bomb sounds like, so that's what made me react in the way I did.
Right, oh my goodness. Okay, well, we're going to go to a break now. Okay. We'll see you all very soon after the break. Welcome back to On the Edge with me, Theo Chalmers, and my special guest, Daniel Obuchike. Daniel, you were just talking about what happened after the bomb went off and how you ran from the bus. I mean, this is obviously a very critical period in the whole basis of what you wrote about in your book. So I think we need to explore this a bit more. So give me an idea of what you saw as you ran from the bus. And this is just seconds after the explosion. Is that right?
Seconds after the explosion, I saw a number of things. I saw a man in black crouching with a video camera. I saw a man with a bandage on his head and a split down his trouser, rolling about, wailing as if he'd come to some kind of grievous harm from an explosion.
How could that be? How could he already have a bandage? If you were the first one off the bus, and I'm asking that question actually, were you the first one off the bus?
I was the first passenger off the bus, yes.
Okay, and no one offered you a bandage. And you passed this chap, did you?
I ran up towards him, and I actually skidded to a halt. That's how shocked I was. When I saw him, I just said, this is crazy. Then I turned around to look at the bus behind me, and then I saw something even more crazy, which was a bus with the top of it completely off. Because being downstairs, I didn't realize. I actually thought there was a car bomb behind the bus initially. I thought that's what my first thought was. I didn't notice until I'd come out and turned around and looked, the whole top of the bus was gone.
So are you saying that the bomb then was on the top deck of the bus?
Well, subsequently that was proved to be the case. But when I'm lying on the floor, I thought the blast was from the back. I didn't realize it was from the top and above at the time. So, but when I ran down the street, I saw this cameraman, I saw this guy with a bandage wailing and remonstrating, and then I looked at the bus. That didn't make sense either. I looked across the road and I saw a kind of a triage point taking shape, and a guy with a bib, which later on coincided with reports of terror drills which were supposedly taking place at various locations in London that morning. So,
In Tavistock Square, apparently.
From where I was, I saw one. And I actually crossed over the road and grabbed the guy by his shirt's scruffs and said, what's going on? And he just told me calmly to go and wait over there. That's all he said, this guy, this young chap. So obviously, he was reacting in some kind of predetermined way. So that's why I say, okay, he was part of that drill, because a bomb has just gone off and people are dying and you're just reacting in such a calm way, as if you've been rehearsing this. And some people say that's what they were, terror drill rehearsals.
Okay, well, I think we need to sidetrack to this a bit from your personal experience of that day, because on that day, or shortly after that day, there were people who went on the BBC and said that they were running drills that day. There was a company called Visor. Was it Visor?
Visor Consultants.
Visor Consultants were running a terror drill on that day. I understood it to be in the train locations. I didn't realise it was in the bus locations.
I heard that from this from the managing director's interview with the BBC. It was 1,000 people in various locations, and that was up to 6 locations. Now, you understand there were only 3 locations where there were tube bombing, so you've got to ask yourself, where were the other 3 locations?
But the chances of them getting the locations right anyway, because apparently they were the exact same locations, but the chances of them getting those locations are remote enough, considering how many underground stations there are. Although the chances are slightly greater if there are 6, and only 3 of them have to be right. But the chances of them actually being in Tavistock Square, waiting for a bus that isn't normally in Tavistock Square...
That's precisely my point, because when I reviewed some of the footage of survivors, the Russell Square survivors went to a location called Brunswick Square. That was where the terror drill or the evacuation point was. And then some of those people there were subsequently in Tavistock Square, which is around the corner from the British Transport Police Station. So that is why I was very confused to see this guy with a bandage. And it also turned out he was at the earlier drill. So that may have explained why his bandage was already on his head.
All right, let's look at picture number four then, if we can. And if you can talk us through these photographs, Daniel.
Yeah.
We have picture number four. Here we go.
Picture number four is...
Right, obviously there's a picture of you on the left here. We don't have to have that explained. Mm. Talk about this in clockwise order then. The top left picture, who is this?
The top left picture is the guy I saw with the bandage. He's seen being helped away from Brunswick Square, which is the Russell Square evacuation point.
Right, okay.
So there was a lot of independent television and camera people there getting interviews from people and taking pictures of people. That's why his face was flashed across the world for a couple of days.
And then the picture next to it on the right?
That's
the top
him.
Right?
That's his picture there.
And where is he now?
That's when he was there at Brunswick Square. But when you see him on the left, he's leaving, he's halfway from Brunswick Square to Tavistock Square. That's where that picture's been taken.
So, sorry, the picture on the right with the blanket round.
Yeah, that's the first one. That's him when he's actually at the Russell Square survivors' evacuation point.
This picture?
Yeah.
Okay, the picture on the right is... Yeah. So both these pictures, neither of these pictures at the top are in Tavistock Square?
No. No,
but you're saying that this man, are there photographs of this man in Tavistock Square?
No, none that I have come across. I only saw him eyewitness and heard him wailing loudly and saw the same injuries, the same trouser torn, the same bandage across the head. And that was seconds after the bus had been destroyed.
All right, what about these pictures at the bottom? Talk us through these. Look, the one on the left, who's that?
On the left is a person who is walking towards the same location, Brunswick Square, which is just down the road from Russell Square, where there's a terror drill in progress, or a terror rehearsal exercise. Uh-huh. And on the right, that is the same man, one and the same. His name is Richard Jones. He was the one who claimed to be on board the bus that I was on and seen a suicide bomber.
He said, didn't he, that he saw the suicide bomber reaching into his rucksack or something?
Yes.
Is this the man who said that?
Yeah, he was the one who was all over the world in a matter of hours saying that he saw a suicide bomber rustling about in a bag, twitching about and irritating him so much that he had to get off the bus when the bus driver opened the door when no one had rung the bell.
Did he
and there
say,
was no bus stop in sight.
Did he? That was handy, wasn't it? Did he say what deck he was on?
Well, initial reports, he was on the lower deck, but later reports, he was on the upper deck, so...
A movable feet.
Yes, one
but
of those
But you didn't
things.
See him get off.
I never actually saw this man in my life when I was on the bus.
So it's possible, it is possible that he was on the upper deck, but it's not possible, you're saying, I'm asking the question here, you are saying, if I'm not mistaken, that it's not possible he could have passed you and got off the bus. You would have seen him.
No, I can't say that. I'm saying it's impossible for him to be on the bus at all if he was at that location at that time. Because the woman in the foreground, you can just see part of her on the third picture, she was given an interview at 24 minutes after the Piccadilly trains had been evacuated. And that coincided with the time of the bus explosion. So he can't be in that picture and be on the bus.
So you're saying that he wasn't on the bus, he couldn't have been on the bus, and therefore his testimony is untrue.
Untrue, yes.
And you suspect, why would he, I mean, you know, what do you think is the reason why he might have given this testimony?
I suspect that was for the real bombers to give them an alibi and blame a young Muslim teenager from Leeds.
Okay, so what we want to know then is, if anybody out there knows who this man is and would like to put him in touch with us, or us in touch with him, we can ask him.
Oh, that would be very helpful.
Can't we? And what about, and the other chap, let's have that picture up again then, please. So, if anybody out there knows who either of these men are, the man with the blanket and the bandage around his head, and the white-haired man, if you know who they are, let us know. Send us an email message on the forum, www.edgemediatv.com. Go to the forum and leave a message and tell us who these men are. And we'll follow it up. And it could be that they're entirely innocent. Okay. Moving right along, Daniel?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the scene in the aftermath of Tavistock Square. I eventually helped some survivor who actually had been walking past at that time to go and get some treatment because she was covered in blood. Another thing was that she was covered in blood and this guy didn't have a speck of blood on him, which meant his vicinity, his proximity to the bus must have been completely, he was in the wrong direction and about 70 yards away. So anyway, I helped this person and then we went for a drink in a bar in Holborn. And then I started noticing these, what I would call, undercover kind of people. I don't know who they were. They didn't look like police because I know what police are like. Police investigate. Police will come up and ask you, what are you doing here? What's your purpose? But these people seemed to just be keeping an eye on me and the woman I was, companion who was escorting me.
And she was also injured, was she, in the...
She wasn't. She was shaken more than injured, but
she was covered in blood.
Well, the one that, she was covered in blood, but obviously they just sat her down and gave her some water and calmed her down. It was later, about half an hour, 45 minutes, when we ended up in Holborn having a drink just to calm our nerves.
Are you saying that, just for the record, that if you were anywhere on that bus or near that bus when the bomb went off, it's almost certain that you would have blood on you from the people who died on that bus?
Anyone walking down the street would have, because if you look at the BMA, the British Medical Association buildings, it was covered in blood. And that blood was from the people on the upper deck. I didn't really want to look to the left. I mean, I caught a glance, that was enough. I just ran to the right. So there were human forms in the gutter. I didn't really need to be told what had happened to them. And as you can see from the photographs, they were torn and flung, hurled against that building. So blood would have been over anyone who was walking down that street that day. So this chap here seemed to be his suit was in reasonable nick.
Blood from a rip along the ceiling.
Yeah, so.
And a bandage around his head with no blood coming through it.
Not really. It just looked like one of those walking wounded, really, but it didn't really add up.
Okay.
So at Holborn, we were sitting down having one or two drinks, and then I noticed these two people come in, standing by the door, looking, oh, he's in there, and doing some. One of them turned away and started talking surreptitiously into a mobile and stuff, while the other kept an eye on me. It seemed as though we were being followed all the way from Tavistock Square down Southampton Road to Holborn. To me, that was just making me more nervous because I'd have just suffered and survived that terrible, horrendous thing that morning, and it looks like it wasn't really over yet. So that began the next phase, and it lasted for a couple of weeks, and I thought, oh, great, I'm just back to work. They're going to name these guys. There's these four faces on the newspaper, and it would be A-OK. But it didn't actually turn out that way because... maybe I had seen something which people didn't want reported, and I noticed these guys, not the same guys from Holborn, but a set of guys who were following me about to work. On my lunch break, they were seeing where I had lunch. On Saturday, when I went for a jog in the park, they were in some MPV. And
it was the same people you kept seeing?
Same trio. So maybe...
Watching you.
Yeah. So I was curious, in a way, why were they watching me?
Yeah, why were they watching you?
Precisely. That's why I kind of knew there was something more to the strange things I'd seen.
How soon did you tell the authorities that you had been on the bus?
I tried to call up the next day, which was a Friday. But they gave me a little slip with a number to call, which was the hotline. Anti-terrorist emergency hotline. So I tried that a number of times, and they eventually took down my details and said, we'll get back to you. But they never did get back to me. So I tried again about 3 days later when they kept pleading for people to come forward with any information could be very useful and stuff like that.
Okay, so you tried again 3 days later. Yeah. What happened then?
The same thing.
What did you say? You said I was on the bus.
Yeah, I was on the bus, and I mentioned a few things which I'd seen, and...
Well, including some of these things that were a bit out of the ordinary.
No, I didn't. I didn't mention that then. I just wanted to say that I was on the bus, just in case they thought I was a terrorist, because they were saying, oh, there was a fifth man, there was an accomplice, a master planner or something like that.
And you thought they might just pin that one on you.
I thought it's a good idea to go and say, yeah, I was there, before they turn up on my doorstep. Okay. Mob-handed.
So presumably they interview you immediately after that, didn't they? A person who'd actually been on the bus?
I would have... That's what I expected, but this continued for months. They didn't interview me until the following year in February, so...
So 7 months mm-hmm. later they interviewed you. Mm.
And later I ascertained... Yeah.
I'm afraid we're going to have to go for another break now, so see you again in a very few minutes after the commercials. Welcome back to On the Edge with me, Theo Chalmers, and my special guest tonight, Daniel Obuchike, who survived the 7/7 bus bomb. So, Daniel, we're just talking about you giving a statement to the terrorist squads or the police or whoever you
the
felt...
Anti-terrorist branch.
About your experience, and they didn't ask you to make a statement. Well, my understanding is they didn't ask you to make a statement until you... filled in a form to claim compensation, despite the fact that you called them several times and said, I was there. They didn't want to know. Why do you think that was?
I think they were trying to conclude their investigation or get their own story out, get that firm in the public mindset before anything came in which could challenge it, because what I had seen may have actually challenged some of the witness reports that they had taken or some of the statements they had got out of people. So there was one Australian woman who was saying all sorts of stuff about the bus, and she said, oh yeah, I was on the lower deck of the bus and a part of the bomb was in my knee, and she's saying all sorts of stuff, and I'm thinking, who is this woman? Where did they get her from? Maybe she was on the lower deck, but I mean, the stuff she was saying was, I mean, it didn't really add up. So obviously some people have been coached and they got their story, and that was what they succeeded in doing.
Okay, so they didn't want the testimony of somebody who was observant like you, and you'd spoken to people about this, and you'd spoken to this woman that you hitched up with at the scene that you then subsequently thought, according to what you write in the book, was an agent.
Well, I initially didn't suspect her of anything. It was only further down the line when she was trying to lead me in certain directions, and then I started thinking back, well, she happened to be just in Tavistock Square in one of the buildings halfway down Tavistock Square. Was she there on purpose for a reason, or had she been going to work, as she told me? And then I actually found out where she worked and done a bit of digging about, and her story wasn't checking out. So that led me to actually suspect her of having ulterior motives for being with me rather than just boy meets girl, as okay. I thought it was that morning.
All right, let's talk about your friend, the chap who died on the bus, or did he die on the bus, Christian Small. Mm. Now, this is an old friend of yours. I mean, this is a bit of a coincidence, actually, that you saw him on the day, but this is a friend of yours that you saw outside Euston Station and said hi to, because he was an old friend of yours. And then, well, take the story up from there. Tell me what happened to Christian.
Well, I saw him at Euston coming out from the mainland station trying to get a bus or...
Just like you were.
Heading towards the buses. I was hesitant, hanging about. I was in W.H. Smith, leafing through a few magazines and stuff. But I saw him, the previous week we had been in a club in Notting Hill actually, it was a bar in Notting Hill. So I said hi, he couldn't stop, he was busy. Then what happened a week or so later was in the newspaper they announced that he had died on the Piccadilly tube train. And I'm saying that's impossible. Firstly, because he would have had to have died at 8:51, which was 15 to 20 minutes before I saw him in Euston. So that was one of the things, maybe that was one of the coincidences which changed my aspect in terms of surviving this thing and what happened to me.
But he is dead, isn't he?
He is. He died that day.
Where did he die then? On the bus?
Of course, he died on the bus.
But you didn't see him get on the bus?
I didn't see him get on the bus because he would have been on the upper deck. So that is one of the things which I thought, that to me, he could only have been on the bus because he was in Euston. To have died on the train, you can't be in Euston then have died on the train. Time doesn't work like that.
No, I know, but I'm just a bit confused now. Mm. I mean, I understand that the chap with white hair, you would have seen him getting off the bus.
Mm.
So if he had been on the upper deck, you'd have seen him get off. And but you didn't see your friend get on or...
No.
So your friend got on and you didn't see him. It could be, it just is possible, isn't it, that a terrorist got on with a rucksack.
That doesn't really compute. My friend got on because he went straight there. I was dilly-dallying. So if he was at the front, he would have boarded one of the people who boarded before me. There weren't too many that boarded before me, but he would have been one of them.
Okay.
If I had been standing next to him, we would have been talking and we would have sat together upstairs at the back. So I don't know. It's just fate. It could be fate. It could be destiny that he went his way that morning and I went my way that morning.
Why were you leafing through magazines? Were you not keen to get to work? Or?
I had no idea of how to get to work from Euston because I'd been totally thrown off course. That's the thing. So I walked into W.H. Smith is right near the exit. So I was waiting for some kind of someone to give us some information. So I just started...
Oh, I see. You thought there might be an announcement saying you want to get back on the trains or...
Something like that,
because you didn't know it was a bomb then, did you?
No idea. We just thought it was a power surge.
Yeah.
So
okay.
That's how I ended up eventually getting to the bus stop. But the thing is, it took a long time for buses to actually arrive that morning, about 25 minutes. Euston normally has tons of buses.
Yeah, sure.
25 minutes and not one bus. So it was like...
And there were lots
biblical,
of people
there. It was like biblical scenes there. When a bus appeared on the horizon, basically. So then it just all changed, and I just dashed. I went... Psh.
You Q-jumped.
Proper.
Okay. Well, I think you'll probably be forgiven for that. I mean, you're obviously a very lucky man, aren't you?
Fortunate.
Yeah, very fortunate man. So there you are in this... You're now in a relationship with this lady. Do you want to name her? It's probably not her name anyway, is it?
I feel no need to name her.
Okay.
To name and shame. I wasn't in a relationship with her. I was taken with the prospect of being in a relationship with her because of the manner in which we had met. We had met on Tavistock Square.
There was covered in blood.
Bomb. Actually, I'll go into a little something about that. There was a woman who was covered in blood, okay?
Yeah.
I was escorting her.
I wasn't. This is not the one you then had this...
Yeah, of course. I'm not going to fall in love with a woman covered in blood.
Oh, might be.
She was covered in blood. I was helping her.
Okay.
And then as we were going to the building where they were helping her, I saw this woman staring at me. And I thought, whoa.
Even at that moment?
Well, I didn't think whoa like that, but I thought she was kind of nice. Anyway,
okay.
But this lady, she was so shocked she couldn't actually speak. I was trying to talk to this lady, she was shaken. So I had to deal with her, and that took around 15 minutes.
You found help for her
inside
one of the buildings there,
inside,
you?
Yeah, a building.
Linton House.
Linton House on Tavistock Square.
Yeah.
Very helpful people there. So they provided water, bandages, so on and so forth, plasters. I got a little plaster for my hand and all that stuff. And then when I came out, that was when I met this individual, who I'd noticed as we'd been shuffling down Tavistock.
Right, so she wasn't injured in any way. Then.
She wasn't hurt.
I was a bit confused.
She wasn't hurt, no.
Okay, so you got into this strange relationship with her.
Yeah, strange, yeah.
This, and all the time you're being followed by people, people are watching you, people have got into your apartment, apparently.
Yeah.
Want to talk a bit about that, about what they did to show you that they'd been there?
Oh, it's just standard things. I mean, these people are very skillful. They're very highly trained in covert surveillance.
Well, not that covert, if you noticed them.
Well,
and they wanted you to see that they'd been there, didn't they?
That's because they were trying to intimidate me. at some points. So obviously, to intimidate someone, you've got to give them a show of force or scare them. So that's why they were a bit hot and cold. At times they were, I couldn't see anything and I was just getting on with my life, but I'm wondering, where are they? Where are they going to pop up from next? And then other times I'm just like, whatever.
And they did things like, in your book you describe how you had a little bowl where you kept 20p pieces for meters or something.
Oh, for the car.
Yeah, and there were five of them in there, or so you thought, but when you came home, it was a pound coin.
Yeah, that was
just... They'd taken your 20p's and changed it for
That was just one of the little games, mind games they kind of like to play, I suppose. But I didn't actually let that get to me, really, because if I had, I could see what they were trying to do. So I'm kind of a spiritual, willful sort of person. If something is wrong, I believe honesty is the best policy at the end of the day. So I had to put my case, regardless of whether people think everything I saw was 100% accurate. Some people have their own kind of points of view. People have been emailing me and suggesting this and suggesting that. I don't mind listening to what you have actually come up with. They call them conspiracy theories, but I want to put a witness testimony, which is different from a conspiracy theory.
So let's cut to the chase here then, Daniel, if we may. What do you think really happened on 7/7? Who was behind it?
I believe there was a shady British intelligence operation mounted under the cover of what were terror drills in London, and many people died and lost their lives and lost loved ones. And I think that is evil. It's a false flag attack, and these things have happened going way back to the days of Rome. So, I mean, it's something that the people are unaware of, and they need to be aware of and on the lookout for, because in these times, I think there's going to be more of them, essentially. So that's why I said, I'm going to say what I've got to say for whatever reason. That's the kind of person I am.
Do you think it now makes you safer? Because if you hadn't said anything publicly and written a book and been on websites, I know you've got your own website, thefourthbomb.com.
Yeah.
And it's the number 4, isn't it?
Yeah, 48.
Thefourthbomb.com. So you've gone public. I mean, do you think that saved you from perhaps being assassinated? Wasn't there a woman, for instance, who was in one of the buildings in Tavistock Square, went on the record as saying that she saw the bomb squad there before the bomb went off, and then suddenly died mysteriously?
I think I read about that in a newspaper somewhere. Someone sent me a clipping about that.
It's in your book.
But with me, it's not about me being safer. It's making London safer. I'm a Londoner, so I wanted everyone to be safer. If everyone is aware of what can be done to them, we all know London as a place where everyone can enjoy themselves and live. We're very diverse, very forward-thinking, and a great place to be. But there are people who will be ruthless and will kill anyone, regardless of whether they are British, English, Londoners, foreigners, and seek to benefit from it. So,
okay, well, how do they benefit from it?
By changing laws, making this wonderful city of ours into a totalitarian fascist state, essentially. Because that's what fascism is. It's futurism. It's to own the future. And the only way they can do that is by taking away our freedoms. And I want to be free like everyone else. So this is a way of me expressing my freedom.
I mean, interestingly, it happened at the time of the G8 summit in Scotland, didn't it, that Tony Blair was at with George Bush and other leaders. Do you think maybe that was his way of saying to them something? If there was an involvement, if there was a government involvement, let's just suppose for a moment that there was government involvement, what do you think that message would have been from Tony Blair to those other G8 people?
I don't think really Tony Blair was involved. There are shady departments far-reaching higher than Tony Blair who can influence departments and get the people on the ground and manage them. So I wouldn't say it's directly, okay, the Labour government did it, New Labour did it. It's not that clear-cut. But the British state is responsible for
MI5?
It.
MI5?
British intelligence. And it's funny because when I launched the site, got a bit of coverage, a couple of thousand people hit the site, and then in December the 1st, 2006, I sent 13 emails to different people who may have been interested with the new footage and graphics and all the details and evidence I'd collected up until that point. And then 3 days later, I had something like 30,000 unique users. So that's when it really started really going global. So that was amazing. That was what really kind of led to the book, because the site was really the main means of getting the information out, the internet. And the internet is a powerful tool. I wouldn't have written that if I couldn't have done a website.
No. So has any branch of the government, the police or the anti-terrorist squad or any of those people, ever suggested that you weren't on the bus or that in some way you were involved in the bombs? Or?
Initially, some people did try to say in December of 2006 that I was never on the bus. And all that did was make me upload information showing me in the background by the bus wreckage, looking around the corner, and there's even footage of me running down the street from a helicopter as well, taken from above, which is kind of strange.
And that's online, is it?
It was online. Someone has still got it, I suppose. So, I mean, there's no question of me not having been on the bus. I even had blood on my shirt and from people who had died, because the lady I escorted was smothered in blood, and I escorted her, so some of that blood
ran off me. And some of your own blood, presumably.
Well, that was just my hand, so it wasn't too bad.
Okay, well, we're almost at the end of the show, Daniel. I mean, thank you very much for being so brave and coming on and giving your testimony. Yeah. And that's all we've got time for. So thanks to everyone for watching, and thanks to Daniel Obuchiki. If you've enjoyed this show, please tell all your friends. Next week, we'll be serving up another slice of challenging television. Until then, remember, they're watching you, watching us, watching them. Cheerio.